You have a finite amount of bitcoins and an infinite amount of shitcoins. Like, either this thing works and then there's one scarce number that we all agree around, or it doesn't work and people just make copies of it and then they all go to zero. Every time a human being interacts with another in any way, we do exchange value with one another. So right now, for you and me, language is our currency. There are very many intangible barter trades happening everywhere, always. Every conversation is a barter trade.
Yeah.
In that sense, hyper-Bitcoinization cannot happen because there will be other exchanges between human beings. The real solution to the scaling problem is that people will simply use money less in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. The fact that you have to pay a dollar to go to the bathroom in the central station of a big city, that's a very fiat-y thing. The more Bitcoin takes over and the more you prioritize quality over quantity, the fewer transactions are needed. As Bitcoin works now, Bitcoin is not what it was back in the days of Satoshi. Bitcoin is what it is. And even Satoshi returning couldn't do anything about that. And that's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
It's an emergent system.
Rules without rulers.
Yeah, it's an emergent system that emerges from a simpler set of rules. Just like all the beautiful things in nature, like the fractal patterns of the leaves and branches of a tree. We are the product of that too.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. This is episode 2 in our Infinity series, and I'm here with Knut Svanholm. Today, we're going to be talking about alchemy. For thousands of years, alchemists tried to turn base metals into gold. They failed, but central bankers succeeded. They found a way to create money from nothing. Bitcoin is the antidote to their alchemy. Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
So tell us about alchemy.
Yeah, alchemy. I say that central banking is successful alchemy. And it is in a way, because they've managed to fool people that dollars and euros and yuans and stuff are as legit as gold is. They used to be redeemable for gold, but they're absolutely not. They can print them out of thin air. So in a way, that is successful alchemy. But if we instead of, the alchemists tried to make gold from other base metals, right? And you can't, because gold is an element on the periodic table.
Apparently they can now. Did you see that recently? Have you looked into that?
No, I have not.
You have not, really? Yeah, they recently, the physicists of the New Alchemist, they were smashing atoms in a Large Hadron Collider, I guess, and they made gold appear.
Yes.
They smashed lead or something together and turned it into gold. They were simulating what happens inside of a sun, right?
Are you sure this was particle a particle accelerator and not a testicle accelerator, and this was the Large Hadron Collider? Like...
Oh man.
Anyway, but if we reverse engineer this, like if we accept that gold is like historically the best form of money humanity has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And why is that? It's because gold is scarce and it's divisible, verifiable, and uniform. It's a mononucleotic metal. So one gold atom is like the other. And it has all of these monetary properties. And the reason that gold became a common medium of exchange or a common type of money is because it had all these properties. Like the free market figured out on its own. The free market is just, and the signaling mechanisms of the free market are basically just interconnected human brains figuring stuff out, even though sometimes they don't realize what they're figuring out. But the free market figured out that gold was suitable.
The invisible hand.
Yeah, exactly. It was a suitable form of money. But if instead of trying to make new gold, we tried to figure out a way to replicate the properties of gold and perfect them, what would such an element have to look like? Well, it would still have to be have many of the same properties as gold. And it would have to be scarce. And since we're aiming for perfect money, why don't we make it absolutely finite? And it would have to be hard to destroy. So it would have to withstand a lot of energy from attacks to destroy it. And it would have to be able to keep its properties over time. And ideally, it would have to be weightless, meaning that it would be very transportable. It would also have to be divisible and all of these things that money needs to be. So if it is to be as portable as possible, it couldn't have protons or neutrons because they weigh much more than the electrons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it couldn't really be a molecule or an atom in the traditional sense because it couldn't have a core. It couldn't have protons or neutrons. It would have to be made up of electrons alone. In other words, it would have to be an informational element made out of information. And if you look at what Bitcoin is, it's absolutely an element in the sense that they are hard to find. They are absolutely finite. And when you find them, since they can have no weight, finding them means finding the location of the element. It is finding the element. So finding the number that represents the element would be the element itself. Which is why I argue in this chapter that Bitcoin is element zero, the informational element. Once you find the location of the element, you have found that particular atom.
I love that.
Yeah.
Did you are you aware of Satoshi talking on the Bitcoin Talk forum? I think he actually made the analogy of Bitcoin to like an element. Have you ever read that or heard that?
I think I have, but a long time ago, so I can't.
Well, see if you can pull up Satoshi's quote when he talks about what Bitcoin really is. He actually does compare it to gold. He compares it. Imagine this this element that has these characteristics, but it's not in the physical realm. It's a really interesting quote. So see if you can pull it up and we'll read it.
Because another interesting thing about the alchemists is if they had actually found a way to replicate gold or make new gold, that would have defeated its own purpose because the value of gold would have gone down because it wouldn't have been finite anymore.
Yeah. So he does talk about gold mining and how Bitcoin mining is similar. But I think the question is so I'll read this quote. It's the same situation as gold and gold mining. The marginal cost of gold mining tends to stay near the price of gold. Gold mining is a waste, but that waste is far less than the utility of having gold available as a medium of exchange. I think the case will be the same for Bitcoin. The utility of the exchanges made possible by Bitcoin will far exceed the cost of electricity used. Therefore, not having Bitcoin would be the net waste. But he says something about, it's a thought experiment of Bitcoin about how he talks about this colorless, he uses the word, I believe, colorless, weightless element or something.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Here we go. As a thought experiment, imagine there was a base metal as scarce as gold, but with the following properties: boring gray in color, not a good conductor of electricity, not particularly strong, but not ductile or easily malleable either.
Yeah.
Not useful for any practical or ornamental purpose. And one special magical property can be transported over a communications channel.
Oh, I don't believe I've seen that quote before, but that's foreshadowing for sure.
Yeah, interesting, right?
Yeah, what a genius he was, that guy.
He was very, very much so, very much so.
So here we can go into Bitcoin mining a bit, because Bitcoin mining is very, very different from gold mining, and I think we've been told the biggest misconception about Bitcoin mining that people have is that miners find Bitcoin, because they don't really. the network pays them in Bitcoin for finding blocks. What they're looking for is not Bitcoin, it's blocks. And the network allows them to give themselves Bitcoin for doing this work. So the block reward, it consists of the block subsidy, which is the newly minted Bitcoin every block, and the fees. And this is what we, the node runners and the users of the network, allow the miners to get paid for finding us block space to put our transactions in. And I think this misconception has led to a lot of other misconceptions in Bitcoin about like the whole notion that we somehow have to care about miner needs is, in my opinion, completely wrong. We should care about users' needs. And the miners are and should always be the slaves of the users and not the other way around, because then the system is already dead. If the miners are in charge, then it's no longer a decentralized system. So it's no longer guaranteed that the 21 million limits will persist.
So, yeah, I mean, the miners are just we're service providers, essentially. We're providing a service and compensated for that service and providing electrical security to the network.
Yeah.
But the nodes ultimately vote on running Bitcoin.
Yeah, and what the rules should be.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what they set the boundaries for what the miners can and cannot do. Mm-hmm.
Now, as a miner, I'm also a user, so I have my node and I
can vote, and in the time of Satoshi, every user was a miner because there was no difference. There was no mining. All nodes mined.
Yeah.
So a Bitcoin user was a Bitcoin miner. So in that case, then it's more true that miners actually found Bitcoin. But as Bitcoin works now, Bitcoin is not what Satoshi. What it was back in the days of Satoshi. Bitcoin is what it is, and even Satoshi returning couldn't do anything about that, and that's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
It's an emergent system.
Rules without rulers.
Yeah, it's an emergent system that emerges from a simpler set of rules, just like all the beautiful things in nature, like the fractal patterns of the leaves and branches of a tree.
Like the Fibonacci numbers and, you know.
It emerges from a simpler set of rules, and I think we are the product of that too. Our human brains are probably
it's
emergent phenomena. That
it's hard for people to wrap their brains around that. They see all of the complexity of life and think that, you know, had to have been just, you know, designed, right?
Yeah, but, exactly. Many people believe that. I am not one of those.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
So miners provide a service, but they also provide a good in terms of block space. So they provide us with a space in an Excel sheet, in a spreadsheet, basically, where we can put our transactions.
Mm-hmm. The miner takes the transactions, formulates them, and publishes that block. You claim that Bitcoin costs $80 billion per kilogram. Can you break that down to me?
Oh, I did that equation somehow. Yeah. I just crunched the numbers into energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, like Einstein's famous equation. And if energy equals mass, if E equals mc squared, and then I took the total number of energies spent on Bitcoin mining so far and crunched that into the equation to convert it into mass, and then divided it by the number of coins in circulation, then you can actually, or something like that, and then I could calculate the kilo price of a Bitcoin.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
How do you like assign a kilogram, which is a weight? How do you assign the weight to that? How does that?
Well, mass is in kilograms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can convert between energy in joules to kilograms, then you can do that equation. But it's just a brain fart.
Mm.
And the funny thing is, the first time I met Adam Back, he approached me because he had done the exact same calculation, but with a different formula, come up with approximately the same number.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's what I'm trying to understand is, like, if Bitcoin is just information with no mass, how can it be more valuable per kilogram than any physical substance on Earth?
It's because mass and energy are two sides of the same coin. It's just that we don't experience that here as human beings on Earth necessarily. But
I'm trying to wrap my mind around that right now, and I'm having trouble.
Energy in joules equals mass in kilograms times the speed of light in meters per second squared. So it's a very simple equation.
Yeah, I've seen it many times. I just in layman's understanding is the problem. Like, I get it, but like I don't get it. You know,
Albert Einstein was a clever guy.
He was a clever guy, man. Not all of us have those. Some of us are just smooth brained. Yeah. You know?
A funny thing, speaking of equations, when at first, when the everything divided equation started doing the rounds first, I thought to myself, like, holy shit, am I going to be remembered for an equation that makes absolutely no mathematical sense? Because infinity divided by anything is infinity, right? So, yeah. So it's like a stupid formula. But then I realized that every single equation or formula that anyone ever came up with made no sense to the people around them at the time because they're novel. And the everything divided equation to me is it makes no mathematical sense, but it makes a hell of a lot of mimetic sense.
Yes, it does make mimetic sense.
And the thing I'm trying to say with through the equation is really that there is no top. There is no upper limit to the purchasing power of a Satoshi.
There's, I think, very early, I think it was Hal Finney did like some math, very basic math, kind of talking about the idea and if this catches on. And
and he came up with like $10 million per Bitcoin or something. He was very early on.
Yeah.
Saylor had that in his talk in Prague just the other day here. Finney was ahead of all of us.
Yeah, he was, absolutely. But since it's not a zero, since capitalism and it's not a zero sum game, the value it's continually growing, which is kind of in line with the formula of like,
and
everything
even,
is growing. There's more value being created here in the world.
Yeah, and
as technology goes on.
It's extremely hard to envision what hyperbitcoinization is like because you have this world in which everything is divided by 21 million if all the other currencies die and every person uses Bitcoin. There are some technical limits. If we divide all the Bitcoin by all the 8 billion people, and believe me, they're not going to be equally divided between all of us, then everyone gets around 230,000 Satoshis. Mm-hmm. Also, we get around 2 transactions per lifetime on chain. So it will absolutely have to scale in layers.
Yes,
of course, if it's to stay decentralized and secure, like if the nodes are going to stay in charge of the network. So there's that. But there are other funny things to think about here. So imagine a world in which all prices fall at all times. Then everyone is incentivized to save rather than spend. Everyone is incentivized to prioritize quality over quantity. And almost everyone's stack would inevitably have to shrink because people are still going to lose their Bitcoins. And the only way because there's almost no financial sector in a hyper Bitcoinized world because of all of those products are mostly a product of fiat currency being a thing. So you can imagine people starting companies not to have black numbers in SATS terms, but just to make their stacks diminish a little slower. So it's derivative of the curve and not the curve itself. And that's absolutely wild to think about. It's very hard to wrap one's head around. But I think in the long run, it makes people less materialistic and not more materialistic. So you will have access to anything you want in abundance, but you will not want it. Because you'd rather just keep the Satoshis, which is also very hard to wrap, and especially here being in America, where everything is commercialist.
Yeah.
That's hard to wrap your head around, too.
The Keynesian economics are screaming in their graves right now.
Anything
you're saying. You said that Bitcoin is pure information at the quantum level. I don't know if this was this chapter, but you went down and you talked about smallest thing. It was really interesting how you talked about bits and maybe you can...
Yeah, I wouldn't put it like that exactly. I'd say what I'm talking about in the chapter is that at its very core, everything is just information. Like the basic the fundamental particles that make up the protons and the neutrons and the electrons themselves and the photons and whatnot and the Higgs boson. You know what? Why
the God particle, as they call it.
Yeah, but do you know? It's funny that it's called the God particle because there was once a Higgs boson that tried to get into a cathedral. And the high priest stopped the Higgs boson in the door, and he said, "Like, I'm sorry, we don't allow Higgs bosons in here." And the Higgs boson is like, "But without me, how can you have mass?"
Oh man, dad joke.
Where was I with that? Yeah. So at the very in the Higgs field or whatever it's called, like the very base layer of mm-hmm. what makes up all the elements. Everything is random, and
quantum physics is so fascinating.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is also random in the same sense. So the chances of an element on the periodic table existing in the universe as sort of comes into being in the same way as a Bitcoin comes into being by being this random number.
Fascinating.
I think that's. It's been a while since I wrote that chapter, so I don't remember all the intricacies of it. There's a video rendition of this chapter that I can recommend if you Google.
Yeah, we'll add it to the links here.
Yeah, if you search for element Bitcoin element zero on YouTube, you'll find it.
Oh, very cool. The discovery of absolute mathematical scarcity, one time event. I feel like mm-hmm. absolute scarcity is like one of the most ingenious things about Bitcoin.
Yeah,
it really kind of is the breakthrough there.
Somewhat revised that and said absolute mathematical finiteness instead of scarcity because scarcity is somewhat subjective. But yeah, I think the it can only be discovered once because the very thing discovered was resistance to replicability. And any replica of resistance to replicability can be copied over and over again. So you have a finite amount of Bitcoins and an infinite amount of shitcoins. It's inevitable. Like either this thing works and then there's one scarce number that we all agree around or it doesn't work and people just make copies of it and then they all go to zero. But the opposite seems to be happening. All the shitcoin market is way smaller compared to the Bitcoin market now in 2025 than it was back in the ICO boom of 2017. So Bitcoin is working. The shitcoins are fading away. I don't think they'll ever go away completely because there will always be scammers and there will always be gullible people. So they will always have some kind of market. But yeah, and I don't believe that a total hyper-Bitcoinization can happen either because people will use other media of exchange. Like, for instance, everything human beings do... This is the first chapter of the first book, by the way, Everything a Trade. Yeah. Every time a human being interacts with another in any way, we do exchange value with one another. So right now, for you and me, language is our currency.
Mm-hmm.
You find it valuable to talk to me. I find it valuable to talk to you.
Otherwise, you just haven't talked to me for long. That's my wife.
But my point is that if we didn't find it valuable, we wouldn't do it.
Of course.
There are very many intangible barter trades happening everywhere. Always, every conversation is a barter trade.
Yeah.
In that sense, hyper-Bitcoinization cannot happen because there will be other exchanges between human beings. And I find it super interesting this because I think the real solution to the scaling problem is that people will simply use money less in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. I think that like the fact that you have to pay a dollar to go to the bathroom in the central station of a big city, that's a very fiaty thing.
Is that actually true?
In Europe, it is.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, really?
Microtransactions.
Wow, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, maybe it's not a thing here because everyone has cars.
That's
wild.
But
microtransactions are, in my opinion, a very fiaty thing. And in a world where Bitcoin is the base money, it's always expensive to use money because of the fees. So there's always some cost attached to it, even though that cost can be very low on the Lightning Network and so on. But imagine, for instance, if you have 10 poor people and 10 rich people, and they go and they have dinner for 10 days with each other. Like, the poor people would probably buy noodles each on their own and sit in their apartment and eat noodles, while the rich people go to a restaurant every night, and every single night one of them picks up the bill. Mm-hmm. So for the poor people, you have 100 transactions, and for the rich people, you have 10 transactions during mm-hmm. the week. And I think this is a phenomenon that is very overlooked. Like, the more Bitcoin takes over and the more you prioritize quality over quantity, the fewer transactions are needed. And also, with Bitcoiners, we are all incentivized to help one another because we are the Bitcoins. Like, we all want Bitcoin to succeed. Therefore, we implicitly want other Bitcoiners to succeed because they are two parts of the same coin, right? So, yeah. So we are all incentivized to just be awesome to one another, which means that fewer transactions are needed between Bitcoiners. We don't need to split every bill. We don't need to, like, so I foresee a world where subscription models, for instance, will increase. So instead of buying, doing a transaction for every single cup of coffee you buy a subscription to a coffee service.
Cool. That's
and you have infinite coffee for the rest of your life. So I think this, there are so many things in economics that are so many unknown unknowns that people don't take into account when they think about scaling issues or security budget and all of this. This is sort of people act as if the market is a static thing that will not change, but the opposite is true. The market changes every second. People valuations are subjective and dynamic. It always changes.
That's fascinating. What do you mean when you say Bitcoin is the bridge between subjective value and objective reality?
Oh, yeah. In a way, all property is. So we human beings, we use means to reach our ends. And the means we use are the things in the objective world that we use to reach a state of less uneasiness mentally. So every human action is based on someone feeling slightly uneasy and imagining a state of the future where they have done something, and then they figure out what means to use to reach that end. And the means they use are usually their property, some stuff that they own. And money, if it's perfect, damn near perfect money, it can theoretically buy you anything else that you need to reach your goal. So it's your most highly valuable good that you can own because you can exchange it for everything else. So in that sense, it's the most direct bridge from the subjective world of valuations and wants into reality, which is the stuff that you buy for the money that you use. So in that sense, it bridges the two worlds.
Fascinating. Anything else you want to talk about in regards to alchemy before we close out this episode?
Yeah, I urge people to go and watch that video. People seem to like it.
We're going to add that to our show notes here so people that watch this will check that out as well.
Excellent.
I think on that note, we'll wrap this episode and we'll be back for episode 3.